Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
You need to leave this town. We don't want you here.
My family and I have never once followed this bull, and we're not going to keep doing it moving forward.
Your children and your children's children will be subjugated.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion passes.
A few moments there of what has been a year of angry attacks directed at public servants. School board members, mayors, city council members, public health officials, poll workers, members of Congress. Serving the public at any time can be challenging. A tough, often thankless job, in most cases, that doesn't pay much. Add a pandemic and a period of deep political division, and those challenges have led some officials to leave their posts and others to question whether they want to start a career in public service. Today on Point, we're looking at how political vitriol, personal attacks, and threats against public servants impact who gets into the field and who stays there, and why we all suffer from fewer public servants who want to solve big problems. We'll start in Los Gatos, California. It's an affluent town of 33,000 in the San Francisco Bay Area, just south of San Jose. It's also home to Netflix headquarters. Mariko Sayoc is a town council member there. Council members in Los Gatos rotate serving as mayor each year. Sayoc held the job most recently from 2020 to 2021. Sayoc says Los Gatos is idyllic, but the community has been having hard conversations about diversity, housing, and community policing over the past year. Mayor Sayoc, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me. I'm very honored to be with you today.
So let's start back in April of 2021. You were mayor. What happened at that point?
In April 2021, as you can imagine, we were heavy during the pandemic. A lot of people were feeling anxious and tired of masking and vaccination mandates. And we started noticing that there was a group of citizens that would appear at our council meetings. We were still doing them online, that were just speaking on a variety of subjects, but speaking with anger and extreme hostility. And that began, I started to notice it in April, and it began to increase in intensity and hostility and started to get extremely personal. And we have our council meetings every other Tuesday. And so every Tuesday, it was just the same group constantly coming, constantly attacking, and increasingly getting personal and personal.
So why do you think this group of people, why were they so angry?
I think it began because of a lot of the diversity conversations we were having in Los Gatos. And coincidentally, at that time, we had, and what we were doing was similar to what many communities were having, were doing nationwide. We were having conversations about the current state of our town and having conversations about what we wanted and what our ideals and goals and values were. And during that time, we placed these banners on our light poles that had four simple words: listen, learn, change, and grow. And for those that participated in this campaign, it was a reminder that as a community, all of us had an opportunity to be a part of this conversation. And I think that became a lightning rod because many felt that I was personally telling them to change and that they needed to grow. And so that came up quite a bit. The pandemic, as many had mentioned, came up. Masking came up. And then critical race theory also started to emerge from the conversation. And in the beginning, during our public comments, we allow a lot of these speakers to speak. In the beginning, I'd politely remind everyone that critical race theory is not a council matter, It's normally a school board member matter, and it's normally a matter that is taken up at a university level. But all of these different issues just started to mesh together and were brought up weekly, and I seem to be the cause of all of that. And as one person said, you know, I was acting like God and making these decisions for them, which was so untrue and so far from the facts.
So in that position as mayor, you're on the receiving end of these heated conversations and shouting. Were you threatened? Did you ever feel frightened?
Not in the beginning, but when comments started to emerge that were very personal and that required some research, I started to get nervous. They started to they'd make comments about where I was born. And so I thought, well, that's unusual. They started to comment about where I worked. And then I started receiving phone calls at work with similar comments and similar sentiments. I started noticing increased traffic around my home. And so that's when I started to get nervous, when it no longer stayed in council meetings, but started to arrive at my doorstep, literally at my doorstep.
Mm. And so why did you stay on the town council then? I mean, that seems really frightening when you feel threatened even in your own home.
During this time, we thought, okay, a lot of our meetings were happening virtually. And in August, Los Gatos was one of the first to bring back council meetings in person. And we thought as a group, well, surely all this anger and this hatred, no one would actually say this in person. No one would behave this way in person. So we thought, let's try bringing council matters back into the chambers. And people would respect that we were in council chambers and we were discussing matters that were vital and important to the town business. And that actually escalated matters and made things even worse, because Tuesdays became just theatrics for those that wanted to cause disruption. These were televised meetings, and I think it was an opportunity for those who wanted a soapbox to take advantage of it. And that's when it started to escalate. But it was a question I asked myself almost every meeting: do I want to go through this one more time? And ultimately, I knew that it was my responsibility. I couldn't back down. And more importantly, I felt like I think I shared this with a colleague. If I felt that I was afraid and that I had no one to support me and I was the mayor, I couldn't even imagine what someone without a voice in my community was feeling. And I didn't want to step away from that responsibility.
Well, you're still on the council. Will you run for re-election?
No. I promised myself and my family that I would not quit, but I would no longer seek public office.
Well, that was Mariko Saya, council member for the town of Los Gatos, California. She previously served as mayor of the town, most recently from 2020 to 2021. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
Now joining us is Meredith McGeehee. She's a consultant and expert in Congress and governmental experts, and she joins us from Fort Washington, Maryland. Welcome back to On Point, Meredith.
Thank you. I appreciate being part of the conversation.
So I want you first to react to what Mayor Sayoc experienced. Is that something that you've seen happening across the country?
Oh, yes. And it's happening all across the country. And interestingly, particularly lots of vitriol at the local level. And people have always kind of had a jaded view of their members of Congress and of their federal officials. And usually as you get closer to people, the state level, the local level, the more that they actually like their representatives. And in the last few years, really with the pandemic, we see the vitriol grow to an enormous level. at the local level.
And that's, it's interesting that you say that, because I, you know, covering national politics, we always see in polling that people dislike Congress, but they like their local, their personal member of Congress. They like their local official. What has led to this dramatic shift that we've seen in the past 2 years?
Well, I think there are a number of factors, everything from the effect of social media, which has given people a sense that they can speak with more snark. And in some cases, that snark turns to true, you know, as they say, vitriol. It's kind of interesting that the previous speaker talked about how when they got in person, it actually got worse. Usually you would expect the opposite reaction. But at this point, I think people kind of feel free to let their freak flag fly and really just kind of let it all out. There's a lot of anger. And where does that anger come from? And I think the anger comes not only from the pandemic, which is hard for people to deal with emotionally, but I would point to three particular factors other than social media. One is just economic disparity. The levels of wealth are so incredibly concentrated that many people are, in fact, struggling to get by, and they see the impact. They see the impact of inflation. They see the impact of closing of restaurants and other things. The other I would point to is just the culture wars. The culture war is real. People feel on the right that political correctness has run amok and that they're being accused of being bad people. And, you know, people don't like to be accused of that. The third factor I would point to is actually something that began more than two decades ago. And I actually point a pretty specific finger to Newt Gingrich, who really tried to change the way Americans have discourse in the political arena.
All right, we're going to pause right there and talk more about it on the other side of our break. We're talking about why elected officials and public servants are leaving their posts and why some don't want to go into public service at all, and the cost for our democracy. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're talking about personal attacks and threats against public servants, from local school board members and volunteer poll workers all the way to members of Congress, and what the cost is of people leaving public service. Meredith McGee is with us. She's a consultant and expert in Congress and government ethics. Meredith, when we stopped off, you were pointing out to three factors for the increase of this economic disparity, the culture wars, and the third, political messaging. I just want to give you a little bit more time to talk about that third point.
Well, some of us who were working in Washington back around before the turn of the century, remember when Newt Gingrich was kind of in his heyday. And one of the interesting things that happened, and I have a very specific memory of this, is that there was a memo that was written in the early 90s for GOPAC, which was Gingrich's conservative political action committee. And one of the things that that memo did that was shared with candidates was to talk about how to change the language in politics. So rather than having an honest disagreement about policy, which is generally, certainly post-World War II, where American politics had been, not totally, we have to remember the days of the Vietnam War and people saying baby killer to LBJ, so I don't want to overstate this. But it went from things of, what should tax policy be, to words where this memo that was shared talked about using words to describe your opponent as sick, as betraying America, radical, pathetic, and these very, very strong value-laden words. And if you look at what's happened over time in the last couple of decades, you've seen that this is the language that is being used in our political discourse. Now, is it one side more than the other? I'll let your viewers and our listeners decide that. What we do know is that former President Trump took this kind of uncivil discourse to levels that we had not seen, you know, in American politics. It's not a matter about ideology. It's really just about the how.
Yeah. So I want to bring in Matt Ford. He's a staff writer with the New Republic, and he's joining us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to On Point, Matt.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I want to get your take of what we heard from Mayor Sayoc and my conversation with Meredith as to what is leading to this increase in vitriol, particularly at local officials, and how particularly the cultural wars and other factors are playing out.
Well, I absolutely agree with Meredith's point that, you know, economic insecurity, that there are a lot of sort of baseline factors that have played a role in this. But I think one reason we've seen an uptick in it, particularly in recent years, is that it's received a sort of new sense of legitimization from people in public office. You know, we know that from Capitol Police records that the number of investigations they've had to open into threats against members of Congress has, you know, astronomically increased since Trump took office in 2017. And so we know that, you know, from that vantage point, a lot of that factor is starting to percolate down now, where we're seeing the frustration that has built up over, you know, perceptions of what students are being taught in schools, over perceptions of pandemic-related public health measures. That is now filtering out, and we're seeing a much more increased willingness to sort of make threats, to make violent promises, and less people in positions of power willing to push back on it.
So, Matt, I know there's a fine line, right, between free speech and having the ability to hold your local officials accountable and to seek redress, as the Constitution said, and the type of messaging we're talking about, the type of vitriol we're talking about. Talk about the difference between those two things.
Well, sure. When you think about American politics, certainly in the past, it's been raucous, it's been rowdy, it's been heated. I don't think anybody can pretend that this has always been a tea party of sorts where we sit down and, you know, calmly discuss our things. People are passionate about these issues. The difference between that is that, you know, with that, that's democracy. When things cross the line to threats of violence, when we talk about intimidating elected officials, whether they be on a school board, whether they serve as a poll worker, an election supervisor, whether they're a member of Congress, that crosses the line from simply expressing one's views to actually imperiling democracy itself. It relies on the implicit use of force to sort of persuade elected officials to do their thing, which is something that we're only supposed to do through the ballot box. That's one of the things that makes this trend so troubling, is that people seem more willing to implicitly rely on violence to achieve their ends.
And Meredith, what is the goal of people? You know, often I will see coverage of folks yelling and screaming at school board or city council meetings. And I ask myself, what do they think they're going to do? Do they think that all the members are suddenly going to say, oh, okay, you know what, you're right. I agree with you now. It seems that a lot of them are angry for the sake of being angry. What are they seeking to accomplish?
Well, most of all, I think they're angry and they're frustrated. You know, what I've worked on issues of government reform, political reform for most of my career. And the whole goal of that is to make sure that government, in the words of Ronald Reagan, is not the problem, right? Because when government doesn't function, when government doesn't respond to the people, then people are going to attack the government. And we've had a situation where big money does, in fact, control many government outcomes, where average Americans don't feel that the government is responsive to their needs. And so they are lashing out, like you would often in other human relationships, lashing out in frustration and anger because they feel like their government is not responding to what they feel are their needs, or it is a government that has stopped listening to what they want. And I don't think in many cases they actually have an outcome per se in mind, other than the feeling that they want to be heard. And of course, maybe this is generational. You know, I had someone tell me that we have a whole generation of millennials that just want to be heard. But you know, I think some of this is really a question of how has the local government responded in a way that is providing people the feeling that their politicians are responsive to the needs they're expressing. And I think many parts of our government, from the state and local level to the federal level, are actually a little ossified. You know, they were devised many decades ago, and they really haven't changed much.
Well, let's go now to a story from someone whose tenure in local public service started out with optimism and hope, but didn't end that way. Amy Peel lives in Novato, California. It's a town of about 55,000 people, a bit north of San Francisco. Amy retired in 2014 after nearly 30 years as the director of transplant operations at UCFS Medical Center. In late summer 2019, she was approached by a group of women who were organizing campaigns for local government.
So they asked to meet with me. I was very impressed. And they were very, very clear, and they'd done their homework on me. And they said, we really want you to run. We really will support you. We'll show up for you. And they did it all. They showed up. They wrote letters. They contributed. So that really touched my soul.
In November 2019, Peel was elected to Novato's city council. And she said she got along with most of her fellow council members, but chafed against some bureaucratic realities, like California's Brown Act, which requires local government business to be conducted at open and public meetings. That sounds good in theory, but Peel said it meant that council members couldn't really discuss issues with each other unless it was at official meetings, which were time constrained.
Prior to this tenure I had on city council, I was always in a collaborative environment. I was in a place where we talked about everything, made the best decision, didn't always agree, but we could do that. This law prohibits that from happening until there's a public meeting. So it was like politics in a silo.
Peel also says she dealt with residents angry about COVID mitigation efforts.
I'm not wearing a mask. You can't make me wear a mask. I'm not getting vaccinated. You can't. So we got all of us in the council got those kinds of things and those calls. And this is my first foray right into politics.
Peel says residents would yell at her and other council members.
All of a sudden, or maybe it was always there, everybody had permission to just be really mean, really rude, beyond. And just for the record, you know, these are not high paying jobs. Okay. You don't do this for the money. In our city, you get $400 a month. So it's not like you're getting rich here.
About a year and a half into her tenure, Peel says the stress of the job got to her. She said she was irritable, not sleeping, snapping at her husband.
I just thought, this isn't good for me. I'm not my best self. I can't do this anymore. It's just not healthy for me physically and mentally. And that's kind of where I got to. And it was hard.
In September 2021, Peel resigned. She said in a public statement when she ran for and won her seat, she was filled with pride and optimism, but the demands of the position in the current climate had severely impacted her health.
It's not for the weak of heart and mind, and it was a lot of introspection, and I know I made the right decision, but I'm not going to tell you it was easy at all.
That was Amy Peel, who served on the city council in Novato, California. Matt, I want to turn to you. You know, this people, as Amy Peel said, people aren't doing this to get rich. They're not doing this for the glory. They're usually doing this because they want to make a difference and impact their communities. How big of an impact is it when folks feel like this is detrimental to their own well-being to even try?
I think it makes it even more so. You know, members of Congress, I think they have a much greater expectation that because they sit on a national stage, because they deal with immensely weighty national issues, they sort of understand that there's a lot more vitriol that they'll get just by the nature of that job. I'm not saying that to necessarily justify it. Of course, I'm saying that just as a matter of human dynamics. But for a lot of local officials, what they have is a set of important responsibilities that often prove to be thankless. And that when you add in this mix of violent intimidation, of threats, the calculus for them as to whether or not they want to stay in that position changes. And I think that's one of the things we've heard so far today is that, you know, if you're taking one of these jobs, that calculus may not turn out in favor of holding it. Now, what that risks doing is driving people who are committed, who are interested in serving the public good away from local government. And when you have positions like school board officials, like local election supervisors, these are really the kind of tissue of our democracy. This is really where a lot of rubber meets the road on the decisions that affect our day-to-day lives. And so if those people don't feel safe, it really invites the idea that other people could come in who maybe are not interested in public service as we think it, who maybe do not have everyone's best interests in mind.
Meredith, is there a way to protect public servants? Is there legislation that can be passed? Is there some policy that can help bring more security to people who want to serve their local communities?
Yeah, I actually think there are ways to try and both increase the ability of public officials to talk among themselves and find more common ground when they don't have to be as performative. You know, I know many people complain since Congress has been televised that, politicians are more interested in performing for the cameras. And I've heard from many politicians that they have concerns about open meeting laws at every level. And I support open meeting laws, but that doesn't mean that the way the current laws are drafted are perfect. There's many things that you could do to try and find ways to have people that really need to resolve conflict, which of course is the purpose of having these democratic institutions. They're built to resolve conflict. That's why I say these are many of the laws that govern how government works were created in the 1970s. And people haven't really revisited those laws. And everything from the ability of members of Congress or local officials to sit down and have a meal together, I worked on laws that and rules that would prohibit gifts from special interests, but that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be travel, there shouldn't be meals that politicians engage in together, but they shouldn't be paid for, obviously, by private interests. But we have a set of laws that have been written in the 70s and that need to be updated. So that's first. The second is local politics is actually more personal. My first job out of college was being a reporter in a town that was had a very, very active political scene. It was a college town. There was a recall when I was there. If you want the shopping center next door and your opponent doesn't, this is very personal. So in some ways, it's kind of common sense to expect more personal conflict than, of course, you know, having a conversation in Congress about what tax policy should be. But there are steps that could be taken that can help at least assuage some of this conflict that's happening.
And Meredith, just the minute we have left, it also seems that these topics are about morality. You know, it's about the masking, the CRT, what's happening to people's, their children. You can't tell me what to do. It's different than policy. Can you just talk in a few seconds about that aspect of what we're seeing?
Well, there's used to be, as I say, a conversation about policy and you'd have an honest disagreement. Now, it is a question of immoral or immoral, and that's happening. I don't want to say it's symmetrical. I actually personally believe it's asymmetrical, but it's happening where either your moral and you support particular legislation, or, you know, otherwise you're immoral. And that's happening on both the right and the left. In my perspective, I think it's happening more on the right at the moment. And I think some of that comes from the ability of politicians actually to get a lot of time and attention. And, you know, everything hot gets more attention. The media loves stuff that's hot. But we really need to try and find ways to both deal with some of the deep moral questions, which is what politics is for, but at the same time realize that sometimes there's just a disagreement about a policy. And finding people that were willing to go into public service and have those kind of conversations is going to be one of our challenges as a people.
Yeah. Meredith McGeehee is a consultant and expert on government ethics. Thank you so much for joining us today, Meredith.
Thank you for having me.
Matt Ford, please stay with us. I just have a few more questions for you about the challenges public servants are facing these days, from deep political divides to the increase in threats against public officials. We'll have more after the break. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're talking about public servants and the impact that political vitriol has had on their jobs. Matt Ford is a staff writer with The New Republic, and he's joining us. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
So I want to talk about you were talking about the increase in vitriol that goes all the way up to members of Congress here in Washington, where I am. And we have seen that threat increasing substantially. Certainly, January 6th was a specific example of that. Talk about how things have changed there.
Well, I think what we've seen is an extraordinary uptick in violence in threats directed specifically at members of Congress for very ideological reasons. I don't want to suggest that, you know, before Trump took office 5 years ago, that this was sort of a utopia where nobody made death threats against members of Congress. Unfortunately, it's always been a reality to a certain degree. But what we've seen is a surprising, extraordinary surge to the point that, you know, in 2016, we only saw, you know, about 900 threats against members of Congress. And as of last year, we saw about 600. So almost tenfold increase, more than a tenfold increase. Just in the past 5 years. And I think that's really changed the nature of the job for makers, that they now have to worry much more about their own security, that they no longer see the Capitol building as an exclusively safe place. It's really injected a strain of fear and uncertainty into the process.
And I want to talk a little bit more about this morality question, too. It seems that over the years, I've been in Washington for 15 years, that it has shifted from the policies and what this other party stands for is wrong to when someone believes that they're on the wrong someone's on the wrong side of an issue. They call them evil. They call them un-American. They say that they hate America. I mean, it has become a much more pointed and much more, you know, zero-sum game type of attack. Talk about that change.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think the January 6th protest is one of the clearest manifestations of that. What we saw on that day was a lot of people that, you know, Joe Biden, one of the most centrist Democrats out there, somebody with an extensive track record in politics and in the Senate, that he was going to represent some sort of existential threat to the American way of life. And you don't get to that point unless you view Democrats writ large as sort of an existential threat, something that is dangerously potent towards the fabric of American life. And I think that stems a lot from how political officials talk, not just how Trump frames his opponents. We know that he does so in extraordinary ways, but how run-of-the-mill Republican officials talk about Democrats. They've used extraordinarily harsh language. They use extraordinarily existential terms. And if you're, you know, a conservative voter who is concerned about these things, it doesn't take much to realize that something needs to be done.
So outside of the pandemic, it seems that a lot of this messaging, a lot of places where we've seen this vitriol surrounds the issue of race, whether it was the pushback against efforts to defund the police, to the idea of critical race theory being taught, putting aside that that's not actually what happens in elementary schools, but this idea that children are being taught to be ashamed of their country because of race. They're taught to embrace racial discrimination or something like that. The race seems to be a flashpoint in many of these vitriolic attacks.
Well, it's been a sad truth throughout American history that that's often been the case. You know, we've talked a lot about how American democracy is supposed to function in this, and we've talked a lot about how discussions are supposed to be carried out civilly and fairly. But we know from history that that's not the case. And we've seen in the past that whether it's during the Civil Rights era, whether it's during Reconstruction, whether it's during the nadir and then the 1910s and the 1920s, the most intense backlash, often taking the form of violence, comes when the sort of perception of the racial dynamic, racial balance of power in America is challenged. I think there's certainly an extraordinary sentiment in some communities that any discussion of this, any push to change the status quo brings an intense backlash. And I think since they see that moment happening once again, there is another attempt to make similar violent efforts.
So is this in part, in a way, a chicken and egg problem, right? If you have a more polarized climate, you're seeing more incidents of this kind of nasty rhetoric, this sort of vitriol in the public discourse, but that's chasing out people who may be wanting to be consensus builders, but they can't in this environment, people who are more centrist. We've seen the exodus of centrist lawmakers from Washington. And then that makes everything more polarized and creates an even greater environment for this kind of vitriol. Is that what's happening?
I think so. And I think it's a terrible feedback cycle. What we have are public officials who are willing to stand up to this feeling that, you know, their voices aren't being heard. And as they either, you know, retire just through the natural attrition of politics, or as they leave for more ideological reasons over these threats, we see people come in who don't necessarily take as hard a line stance in them. And now the other flip side of the coin is that when that happens, it seems to legitimize it for people. So they get a sense that these sorts of tactics are acceptable. And so what we see is sort of a dynamic where that just moves even further towards a very dangerous place for an electoral democracy.
Yeah. This is from one of our listeners on Twitter. It says, placing value on our public servants, be they elected or civil, is critical to a functioning democracy. Attacks send a message to more than the servant being attacked. They tell everyone that service isn't appreciated. What are some solutions? How do you make people put more value on public servants at a time when they are under such attack?
I really wish that I had a sort of panacea solution to that, something that could fix this overnight, that there was a policy change that could be made, that there was a sort of strategic or rhetorical shift that could be made that would really fix this. But I think this is a cultural problem. I think this is something that is very deep-rooted, this sense of alienation and frustration Some of it, you know, coming from legitimate sources. It's a long pandemic. People are frustrated. They're tired. Some of it coming from not so legitimate sources. I think that, you know, the best option is to ensure that, you know, when public officials do have the opportunity out on this, they take it, that they stay, draw a strong line against threats and intimidation, even if they're targeting people they don't normally agree with. I think that's something that everybody can hopefully agree on, is that we want public officials to be able to function and carry out their duties and responsibilities free from intimidation. Beyond that, I think that people should also take the opportunity to make sure that they aren't contributing to the problem. I understand, obviously, I certainly get frustrated with the state of American politics these days. But I also understand that sometimes anger and frustration is not always conductive. So I think it's really a broader thing that needs to be addressed. Now, the one thing that can be done is, if you're in local government, is for legislatures to take more steps to protect people. You know, we've spoken a lot about the threats members of Congress face. They have their own police department that's dedicated to pursuing these and investigating these. If you are a city council member or a school board member or an electoral staffer, you might not have those same resources. And we've seen some legislators in Oregon and California, in Maine and Vermont, think about ways to, you know, increase penalties or provide more resources to election workers or school board members who face threats. And so I think that state legislators have an opportunity here to really step up and ensure that the sort of connective tissue of our democracy isn't allowed to be attacked any further.
I want to get to a couple more statements from our listeners. One on Facebook says, the person in my office who answers the incoming calls from the public, I work in the sewer department of a mid-sized Midwestern city, says that in the last year, people have gotten a lot more hateful and nasty on the phone than they were before. She's been doing this for years and said there have always been hateful people, but they were the exception, and now they're more the rule. She says that by Friday, she's burned out and ready to quit. It's definitely happening to people at all levels of government who are just trying to do their jobs and serve the public. Another listener on Facebook says, please don't give up. We need good people. Take a break if you need one, but don't quit. Matt, is there a way to recruit people into public office? I mean, we heard from Mayor Sayoc at the beginning, who says that that's why she got into office. Someone recruited her. She was retired and said, you know what, this would be a really good thing to do. And she agreed. That's harder now. Is there a different way to try to recruit people and to try to think about and talk about public office?
I think that is especially important at the local level, because that's the area where people have the most opportunities to get in and participate. I know that, you know, there are groups that are more aligned with Democrats and that, you know, have encouraged grassroots participation, that have encouraged to run for offices in their backyard that they can make a difference in. I believe Run for Something is one of them. But I think that, you know, even if that's not necessarily the exact ideological balance that you have, there are probably groups out there that would be able to help, and that I think people can look in their own communities and see what sort of options are available to them, where they can make the most difference. You know, one of the great things about living in a democracy is that if you have a problem with something, you do have a certain amount of latitude to change it. And so if people step up and decide they want to serve, they are a little more free to do so.
And, you know, we're talking about how much this is happening focused on the local level, but certainly the national dialogue, the national temperature helps to fuel this, right? I mean, is that where some of this needs to start? I mean, if cable news outlets are talking about critical race theory, and that can take such a hold that it can take a pretty blue state like Virginia become a key issue in a gubernatorial race, and then have the Republican who pushed that issue win. If it's seen as an effective strategy, is there any incentive to stop it?
I worry that, you know, one of the problems with America, and, you know, the fact that we do live in a democracy, is that since we have agency, since people have agency, they often forget that other people have agency too. I think it's easy to assume that you know, this might go away naturally on its own, but the fact is that there are people who make money from this. There are people who enjoy the fact that their livelihoods come from riling people up. And I don't want to draw with too broad a brush here and say that there aren't people who make death threats against Republican politicians, or that there aren't people on the left who take things too far. But we do know that there is a conservative media establishment in this country that makes a tremendous effort to get its base and its supporters frustrated and outraged. And while, you know, the vast overwhelming majority of those listeners and that audience won't take, won't make threats, won't make further worse actions, it doesn't take many for that to happen. I think we've actually, I hate to say it, I think we've been lucky so far that things have not gotten worse. We've had a number of close calls against members of Congress over the past few years, most notably, of course, the congressional baseball shooting, most notably the January 6th attack. I hope that people realize that they have strong incentives to ensure that things don't get worse. And I really hope that they have that realization before it actually happens.
And I want to underscore that certainly the threats are, there's no, it's happening to members of both parties, all parties, and that congressional baseball shooting, which I covered on the ground, was really horrific against Republicans. And of course, January 6th, they were targeting both Republicans and Democrats. I don't want to say for any moment that the threat of violence is only against one party. Just before we go, I want to talk a little bit more about the money. You mentioned people making a lot of money in pushing this type of messaging. And I just want our listeners to understand that a lot of times this isn't a grassroots effort, that this is a carefully strategized, funded effort to gin up these topics.
Right. And I think that, you know, some of it overlaps with legitimate democratic expression. People do, you know, feel like they want to have more of a say in how public health policies are decided, how masking policies are decided for schools. Those are legitimate topics in a democracy. What we have to worry about is that they get caught up in other topics that are more troubling, and that they get caught up in vehicles for expression that are more troubling. I think we've seen, especially last year, how Fox News can take perhaps, you know, frustrations about the way that some things are handled in Loudoun County, Virginia, turn them into a national referendum of sorts on a variety of issues, whether it be how racism are taught in public schools, whether it be how public health measures are taken in public schools, and that as soon as that passes, as soon as the electoral need for that passes, they just switch to something else. And, you know, it's fine. People can discuss political issues, of course, but there is something to be said for people who sort of do a drive-by focus on an issue and then are free to move on and then leave sort of the vitriol behind for people to deal with in those communities. I would hope that people take more responsibility for these actions in the future, and I hope that they do so before things get out of hand.
All right. Matt Ford is a staff writer with The New Republic. Matt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow, we will spend the whole hour talking about the situation in Ukraine. The U.S. and the West warn Russia repeatedly not to invade, but Russian President Vladimir Putin chose war. So what can the U.S. and its allies do in response? What questions do you have for our panel of experts about Putin and Russia, about the options the NATO that NATO and the UN have, about the Ukrainian people, or why, as Americans, we should care about what's happening in Europe? Call and leave us a message at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.